Welcome to today's internet seminar on understanding the fiscal year 2012 brownfield ARC guidelines. My name is Jan Pelch with the US EPA. I'll be moderating today's session. We're going to get started in a minute, but while we're waiting for others to log on, we're going to cover a few housekeeping items. If you look at slides 1 and 2, the slide 1 is our intro, and slide 2 describes the housekeeping items, such as pressing star 6 to mute your phone. I'm going to give you all a second to press star 6. And then we're going to have some question and answer sessions later on. And at that point, to unmute your phone, you can press pound 6. So let's everybody press star 6. All right. If you have a hold feature on your phone, please do not put us on hold. A lot of organizations have hold music or advertisements, and that can be disruptive. So please keep us on mute. Don't put us on hold. So we should be on slide 3 at this point, which is just our beginning slide, our intro. If you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, for those of you who are doing this presentation, observing it online, you can use the icon that with a question mark to alert us to technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a phone number where you can be reached, and someone will try to help you figure out what's going on. So if you notice at the top of the screen, there is a row of icons. The question mark can be used at any time to submit a question. We'll see your questions as you submit them. We encourage you to do submit questions along the way as they come up, and then we'll answer them towards the end of the session. You can also use the column to the left. There is a bar that has the slide numbers, or you can use the right arrow at the top of the screen to advance to the next slide, and we'll be announcing which slide we're on. For the most part, we'll be doing that. So, what we're going to do is probably archive this session so that at some point within a couple of weeks, if some of your coworkers missed it and they want to go back and listen to this and take a look at the slides, they should be able to access this through the CLUIN website. So I think at this point we're ready to start our session. And today we have three speakers, including myself. We have Matt Didier, Carrie Cragen, and myself. Each one of us has more than 10 years' experience with brownfield projects. And so with that, I'm going to ask you to advance to slide 4, and again, ask you to please all press star 6 to mute your phone. So I'm going to wait one more second for that. Okay. All right. So let's go to slide 5, which is basically an overview of the materials we're going to cover today. We're going to talk about the types of grants that were the information here is being provided for. It's the ARC grants. We're going to talk about how competitive the process is. Those of you that have participated before know that it is a very competitive grant process, and there are more limited funds this year.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press pound 6.
Okay. The other thing, if you look at that slide 5, we're going to cover the threshold criteria, the ranking criteria, some tips on preparing a good proposal, and then at the end we'll talk about some additional resources that are available either before you potentially are selected for a grant or after. Slide 6 has basically a definition of a brownfield site, and I think those of you that have been working on brownfield grants know what our EPA definition is under our brownfield law. It's real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. And this is a good general definition for these grants, especially for the assessment grants. If you are looking at applying for or for submitting a proposal for a cleanup grant or an RLF grant, especially for cleanup direct grants, you must demonstrate there is contamination. So this part of the definition is the potential presence of a contaminant. Well, if for a cleanup grant, you have to have actual contamination. The other thing I just want to quickly mention is we may occasionally use the word proposal and application interchangeably. So if we accidentally say application in your application include this, we really are talking about right now preparing your proposals. All right, let's go to slide 7. That just talks about the purpose of brownfields, basically to help determine what types of contamination are on properties that may be impeding redevelopment and assisting with cleanups of the properties so that the properties can get put back into reuse. The environmental assessment and cleanup types of work are what we're going to cover today. We're not going to talk about job training. There is a separate grant program within our program for job training. It's on a separate track in terms of the proposals and anyway, yeah, I'm babbling. Okay, let's go to slide 8. Benefits of brownfields revitalization. I think all of these are things that you'll want to look at when you're preparing your proposals. There may be other benefits that you'll include. Slide 9 covers the kinds of contaminants other than what we would call hazardous substances. Petroleum is another special group of contaminated sites that are now eligible for funding since the brownfield law was passed. Asbestos and lead-based paint are eligible, and you no longer have to demonstrate a release to the environment for these contaminants. Controlled substances are specifically identified in the brownfield law, mine-scarred lands, basically any contaminant that might be present or potentially present could make a site eligible for funding. Okay, slide 10, just another overview of how we operate. We work closely with our state agencies. You'll see later on that you're going to need to get some information, documentation basically from the states, a support letter with your proposal, and then also if you are looking at sites that are contaminated with petroleum, you'll need to get a low-risk letter from your state to submit with a proposal. Slide 11 goes through, it shows the types of grants that are available through our brownfield program. Today we're going to be talking about the assessment, revolving loan, and cleanup grants. We call those the ARC grants. Up to $200 million is authorized in the law. However, we are rarely funded, and we've never been funded to that level. We have a $50 million set aside, and again, that's in the law. We've never been funded up to that maximum either, for states and tribes. And part of the work that our state and tribal programs can do includes assessment of properties. So there is the potential, we'll talk about later, if you need assistance assessing a property either between now and when the new grants are awarded or after or any time, actually, you can contact your states to see if they can assist in doing an assessment for a property that is eligible. 25% of the funds by statute need to be spent on petroleum-contaminated sites. And slide 12 also kind of summarizes the ARC. That's kind of how we get that acronym. We're going to talk about the ARC grants, the Assessment Revolving Loan Cleanup. We also call these 104K grants, part of the legislation that authorizes our ability to provide these grants. We also call them competitive grants. We no longer call any of our grants pilots. All of our pilots prior to the law being enacted have all, I think, been closed out. Slide 13 describes the amount of funding for each of the three types of grants that we'll be talking about today. One different thing this year is that EPA plans to award 50% of the assessment and cleanup funds to new applicants, and new would be any applicant that after the passage of the law you have not received a brownfield grant or you currently don't have a brownfield grant. So that's a little bit of a change this year. We talk about these as grants, but you need to be aware that once, if you are selected, the grant or the funds will be awarded actually as cooperative agreement, which by definition involves significant EPA interaction with the grantees. So even though we call these grants, they actually are cooperative agreements in the end. So you'll be assigned a project manager who will also act as your project officer. And so if you are selected for a grant, they'll work with you after you're notified that you were selected to prepare a work plan that would be reviewed and approved by your project manager. And then you would need to submit an application package. And so if you look at the next slide, slide 14, there's a timeline for submitting the proposals. And so you can see really the next big date is November 28th. That's the proposal submission deadline. You can submit grants via grants.gov. If you go that route, I recommend that you go onto grants.gov now and register so that if on the 27th or 28th you're getting ready to submit your proposal, you will actually be registered in the system. I've heard that it can take a couple of days to get registered. So if you even think you might want to use that venue to submit your proposal, I would definitely go in and register now. Total amount expected to be awarded is $65 million. The previous slide had the breakdown for the specific types of grants and the amounts of funding that would be available, and that all adds up to $65 million. In the spring, sometime, we never know exactly when, but sometime in the spring, the announcements will be made, and you'll be notified if you're selected. And again, you'll work with your project manager to develop a work plan and a cooperative agreement application package, and awards should be made sometime by the end of the summer at the latest. If you go to slide 15, there is a link to the proposal guidelines, and there's also the link to the grants.gov. This training is really just an orientation to the guidelines. You must read them. They've changed significantly, and hopefully if you've looked at them in the past, you've probably already noticed a lot of the changes. But it's very important that if you applied in past years and were not successful, it's important that you go back and look at your proposal and adjust it based on the current guidelines. We don't want you to miss anything and get points taken off because it was not responsive to the questions in the current guidelines. All right, so with that, we'll go to slide 16, which is the beginning of the assessment grant discussion. Okay, so I'm going to talk just a little bit about, in general, about our grant assessment, or assessment grants, pardon me. The purpose of assessment grants is to assess properties. The types of activities that are typically included in assessment grants are listed there: inventorying, characterizing, assessing. You can prepare cleanup plans for individual properties. You always want to include some community involvement related activities, which Matt will discuss later on in the ranking criteria section. There are three different types of assessment grants that you can submit a proposal for. There's the community-wide. You can submit a proposal that includes up to $200,000 for hazardous substances, or up to up to $200,000 for petroleum-contaminated sites. You can submit them separately as proposals. It's not going to affect the viability of the proposal if you put them in one proposal. The only thing that you need to think about, if you're going to include both hazardous substances and petroleum in one proposal, again, look at the guidelines. You'll need to have two separate budgets, but you can submit them individually or together. It's all the same here. The site-specific grants or proposals on slide 17, you can submit a proposal for up to $200,000 for petroleum or hazardous substance contaminated sites. You can request a waiver of that $200,000 limit and ask for up to $350,000. You need to provide justification and an explanation of why that additional money is required for the assessment. That will kind of depend on the size and the complexity of the property. Only one application in terms of the site-specific or proposals can be submitted, and it is subject to the site eligibility and property ownership criteria, which is a threshold requirement, and that will be covered in later slides. Slide 18 describes the assessment coalitions. You can apply for or submit a proposal for up to $1 million in hazardous substance and or petroleum funding. A coalition consists of three or more eligible entities, so each individual entity must be eligible on its own to apply for a grant, and then you would basically include all three together in that proposal. You want to be sure that three entities are eligible, because in the event that during the threshold review it's determined that one entity is not eligible and therefore only two entities are left in that coalition, the proposal may not go forward for ranking. So you can always check in here to see if your entities are eligible. You must assess a minimum of five sites, and if you apply as a coalition member, you are not eligible to apply for the individual community-wide or site-specific grants in that same year. And the last slide I'm going to talk about is slide 19, and that is just a summary of the assessment, application, or proposal options. So if you're an individual community, you can submit up to three grant proposals, and in reality, we talked about the fact that the community-wide hazardous substance and petroleum, you can combine them or submit them individually. We would consider that two proposals, and you can submit one site-specific proposal, or you can submit a proposal as part of a coalition. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Carrie Cragen to talk about the Revolving Loan Fund grant program, starting with slide 20.
Hello, I'm going to talk about who's eligible in the Revolving Loan Grant Program. Again, this is not a loan we give to you. This is a grant or cooperative agreement that we give to you to capitalize your own loan program. As you can read, $1 million per eligible entity, and that can be split up into all loans or up to 50% in subgrants. The slide states that nonprofits are not eligible to apply. I want to clarify that eligible entities for revolving loan funds are the same entities that are eligible for assessment grants. This is similar to a community-wide assessment grant. You state your jurisdiction, you state that you're some type of political subdivision of the state, and then you can make loans to yourself, to other governmental entities, to nonprofits. You can give them loans, and you can also loan to private entities. When it comes to a subgrant, subgrants can only be given to a nonprofit from your loan program or to another governmental entity. You can't subgrant to yourself. If you've seen this 50-50 before, it used to be 60-40, but we have increased the subgrant limit. On slide 21, again, these loans and or subgrants are given for eligible cleanup activities. And if you are going to apply for these and you have an existing RLF grant, you must be part of a coalition. Existing RLF grantees cannot apply under this round as new entities unless they are part of a coalition and they are not the one receiving the grant, because if you're a coalition of three eligible entities, one of those is the recipient and the others are coalition members. Another thing to be careful of in your application is that we limit it to $1 million per separate eligible entity or $3 million for a coalition, but within that you need to break down your hazardous and petroleum budgets. So while you don't have to name sites yet, you should have an idea of what types of sites and what the breakdown between hazardous and petroleum substance cleanups that you would need. And again, don't forget that the cost share is 20%, so if you're applying for $1 million, you need to come up with $1.2 million of eligible activities under the program. These are longer than the assessment cooperative agreements, which are 3 years. It used to be 2 years, but now are three. The RLF ones are 5 years because it takes a while to get a revolving loan fund up and started, and then once you start making loans and get funds back in return and make loans again, we realize that there it does take a longer amount of time and that can be extended. Slide 22 is a pretty picture, but also one of the threshold requirements besides showing that you're eligible to receive a revolving loan fund grant, saying what your jurisdiction is, and that's important because once you choose the sites, they must be in that jurisdiction. Slide 23, this is eligible cleanup activities. You'll hear these again because they're similar to the cleanup grants, identical. The types of things you can do with those loans and or sub-grants. Obviously, most voluntary programs will have all of these things under their remedial action plans, installation, site controls, regular cleanup, capping, removal on slide 24, abatement of asbestos and lead. Again, since 2002, the brownfield statute has stated that brownfields are a wide range of cleanup activities can happen there, and they're not limited to a certain definition. It's real property, so you have mine scarred lands, lead, asbestos, all sorts of things that previously weren't eligible. Don't forget, under the cleanup activities, the preparation of the remedial action plan and preparation of a closure report on both ends are eligible activities. Under slide 25, this is a list of the don'ts, things that you can't use those loans or subgrants for. Acquisition, redevelopment, meaning what goes on after the cleanup. Environmental assessment, meaning you should know what you're cleaning up before you get there. Obviously, if you need to do some confirmation sampling as part of your cleanup, that's eligible, but not straight phase one or phase two. And we don't do a reimbursement of costs already incurred prior to engaging the loan. And these are important. This list is important not just for the loan, but don't forget the 20% cost share requirement. And the cost share has the same eligible activity requirement. So you can't use the purchase of a property or the acquisition as a cost share for a loan or a subgrant. They have to be things that would be eligible for funding under the loan. Next slide is slide 26, the cleanup grant program. And cleanup grants are just like a subgrant in an RLF, but the cleanup grant is given directly to the eligible entity. And this is the one category of grants that can go directly to a nonprofit. All the eligible entities from before for RLF and assessment grants are eligible under the cleanup grant if they own the property at the time of proposal submission. And that is not, you have a contract and you're going to close on it in December. You must have fee simple title at, what's the date, November 28th. So November 28th is the date you would need to own the property. This is for up to $200,000 per site, and you need to delineate whether that is all hazardous substance or all petroleum or some mix of the two. You can apply for up to three cleanup grants from each eligible entity, but you need to do separate proposals because they will each be competing differently. You might get one, you might get three, you might get none, or all of them. So they'll be competing against each other with all the other applicants. If you do combine the two in one proposal, you just need to make sure, again, that it adds up to $200,000 at the most. And don't forget that there is a cost share requirement and the previously stated eligibility thresholds apply to that cost share, too, for eligible costs. One thing to note on the cleanup grants is that we do require community notification in advance of the proposal. And this year it includes the ABCA requirement, which is the
analysis of brownfield cleanup alternatives.
I didn't spell out the the acronym. And that's a new one this year. So if you are applying for cleanup grants for sites you may have applied for in the past or you're new to the program, in previous years the ABCA was required once you were in the cleanup. Now we required upfront along with that community notification, and those are part of our NEPA requirements. So please pay attention to that and make sure to do it early. And now we are on to Matt Didier with the threshold and ranking.
Slide 27.
Our guidelines that you will see once you get into them are kind of broken down into two steps. First, an applicant demonstrates to EPA that their proposal fits all the requirements that are set out by the brownfield law. And once that step is completed, then those applicants that are eligible to receive funding will have their proposals scored and ranked. The threshold criteria are kind of pass-fail questions that the guidelines ask applicants to respond to let us know that the applicant itself is eligible to receive funds and that the site, if you're applying for the kind of grant that requires you to identify a site at the point of application, is also eligible. Some of the, we're on to 29 now.
Okay.
Some of the criteria are shared by all the grant types. Some are exclusive to certain ones. Everyone has to be an eligible entity. We have a definition of what those are within the guidelines and within, I think, the Federal Register notice and our federal regulations, but governments, as Terry was saying, pretty much any subdivision of the state is eligible for any type of the grants. Additionally, not-for-profit organizations, those incorporated under 501c3 or some other similar section of the IRS code are also eligible to receive only cleanup grants. Every applicant needs a letter from their state or tribal environmental authority supporting their application. Within our presentation today are the list of all the people you would go to in the various states to get that letter. The RLF and the cleanup grants require a 20% cost share. This is funding that the applicant provides as the grant is drawn down to split the expenses of the project. Demonstrating that you have a cost share does not require that, you know, you have 20% of the requested funds in cash sitting in an account somewhere waiting for the grant to be awarded. There are many ways to make up your cost share. At the point of application, we really just need a statement from the entity that they will provide, that they agree to provide this cost share from eligible sources. Community notification applies, again, only to the cleanup grant. We'll talk a little bit about that in more detail in a little bit because it's a bit different this year and a bit more complicated. And then the RLF grant has requirements for the applicant to show that they have legal authorities to manage an RLF and a legal description of the jurisdiction that they are, that they cover. Again, applicants respond to all the thresholds. You pass or you fail. I think we're just going to zip through these because it kind of covered all of them. For the coalitions, briefly, every member of a coalition has to be eligible on its own. At the point of application, we need a letter from each of the coalition partners simply saying that they agree to participate in the process.
And if I can interject for a moment, there's a question that just came online I see that we can answer right now, which is, can you combine a tribal with a community application as a coalition? And the answer is yes, because if they are both eligible entities, they are both eligible to be part of a coalition.
Slide 33 there is a quick overview of what types of organizations are eligible. We've already talked about that. Coalitions, RLF, you need two or more members. ARC, you need three or more. Again, each one of them has to be eligible on their own. For the cleanup has a couple of its own unique eligibility requirements. First is site ownership. in order to receive a cleanup grant, the applicant must own the property by the date of the application, and they must hold this property fee simple title. So a proposal that says the applicant has an option to buy the site, or someone is a related organization is holding ownership of the property, is not going to make your project eligible for a grant. Cleanup grants require that each site have some phase two work completed at the point of application. A written phase two or some other similar report that involves actual environmental sampling at the site.
Okay, that was slide 35. We're going to 36.
There are some sites that we know are definitely not eligible for cleanup grants. Those are sites on the NPL. Sites that have an existing enforcement order on them that mandates the cleanup that your grant would otherwise propose to accomplish. And any property that's owned by the U.S. government cannot be, the cleanup of that cannot be funded through one of these grants. For site eligibility, who makes the decision about eligibility depends on the type of grant. For the hazardous waste sites, EPA makes the decision based on the information you provide. For petroleum projects, the state makes the decision, the determination if the site is eligible, and you will provide the information to them in a sufficiently timely manner in order for them to make this determination prior to when the application is submitted. And again, we have a list of who you contact in your state to get that determination made. Particularly if you have a petroleum cleanup grant, you would do well to contact them soon and find out their date by which they have to have information from you to make their decision.
That was slide 37. We're going to 38.
It was easier. Buster letter. Okay. Better from the state.
Slide 38.
You know, I'm going to skip this AA, I think, because it's just a little bit here.
Okay. We're moving on to slide 39.
We're moving on again. We're skipping up, actually at this point, we're going to skip up to slide 41. And this is, again, about the site ownership and how someone's talking, and how the applicant acquired the site and that's effect on its eligibility. There are really two ways that an applicant can acquire a site involuntarily, and this is through means of a tax foreclosure or an eminent domain taking, or a voluntary acquisition, which is a purchase or a willing acceptance of a donation of a site. And depending on which type of ownership you've used will determine how you will present your eligibility of the site. Sites that are acquired involuntarily are automatically eligible to receive funding. You don't need to demonstrate any other kind of CERCLA defense. So as long as it's not one of those sites that's listed as the, you know, drop-dead sites, and you've got your phase two information on it and you own it, the site's in. If the site, we're on to 42, if the site was acquired voluntarily, the applicant's going to have to demonstrate how they went through the process of investigating the site and how they've maintained the site in order to avoid any kind of CERCLA liability that would make them ineligible to receive a grant. This liability shield, which we call a bonafide prospective purchaser defense, is composed of two parts. Up front, there's the investigation. which we call all appropriate inquiry. What that is depends on when the site was acquired, but it generally means that the general requirement is that a phase one, according to the standards, the ASTM standard that existed at the time of acquisition, is your all appropriate investigation. These phase ones have to be done no more than 180 days prior to taking ownership of the site. If it is, you will have needed to update the phase one if you didn't do a completely new one. I think the ASTM standards tell you how you can update a site.
Right. Otherwise, it can't be older than 1 year. It has to be less than 1 year
okay.
old and can be updated. Certain parts can be updated in 6 months.
Okay. We're on to number 45. This is a quick overview of what we think is equivalent to a phase two when we say you need a phase two as part of your eligibility requirements for a cleanup grant. Again, 46, your petroleum sites. The state reviews these decisions to determine that the site's relatively low risk and there's not a viable responsible party. The important thing to note here is that the state can really use whatever criteria it chooses to determine if the petroleum sites are eligible or not. In all of the states in our regions, the state agencies make these decisions, and we have yet to have a problem with any of them. A couple additional requirements for the cleanup grants on 47. Once you get the cleanup grant, you can only use it on the site as you have defined it in the application, and you have to maintain ownership of the site throughout the period of the cleanup. As soon as the cleanup's closed out, you can sell or give away the property to whomever you want, but as long as you got cleanup going on, you got to own it. Oversight structure, legal authority, page 48. We're going to ask you who's going to oversee your cleanup under either the RLF or the cleanup grant program. Again, in the case of this region, all of our cleanup oversight ends up being done by the states, either through their voluntary cleanup program if they have one, or some other voluntary mechanism that a state agency runs. We haven't overseen any of the cleanups ever funded by any of our grants, nor would an applicant want us to do that. Cost share, I think on 49, we've kind of covered that. Again, the cost share doesn't have to be a big lump sum of cash that you have up front. You can generate it through in-kind services. For your RLF grants, you can pass that cost share requirement on to your loan recipients or subgrantees. You can request a waiver of the cost share for financial hardship. The decision whether to award that waiver is made at headquarters. I've seen them awarded, but I wouldn't say routinely or really with any frequency.
Slide 50.
Slide 50. Community notification. This only applies to the cleanup applicants. And this is essentially our effort to make sure that we are doing the environmental assessment necessary at a construction site at a cleanup site prior to the work being done when using federal money. So we're complying with environmental assessment requirements. It boils down to a couple things: what kind of documents you prepare and how you give notice of those. So you need to prepare your grant application. Grant application itself is the subject of the community notification. In addition, you need to prepare what we're calling an analysis of brownfield cleanup alternatives. And this is a short document. I think you can find it better described in our frequently asked questions, number 71. It's a short document that describes a couple different possible cleanup strategies for the site, some high-level cost estimating, and a recommendation of what cleanup strategy to pursue at the site. I would contend that if you have enough information about your site to write the cleanup description that we've always required in these applications, that you have enough information to complete your ABCA. So we've taken a lot of questions about this with people concerned about the amount of work that's required to do an ABCA. We're not viewing it as a very detailed document, and we are the, in this case, the regional office, the regional program office will decide what constitutes a sufficient analysis of cleanup alternatives.
Okay, and we're just going to interject here that slide 29 showed community notification under each type of grant, and that slide is incorrect. It is just required for the cleanups, as Matt pointed out here.
Okay. So those are the documents. You need to notice them. You need to post an ad in a paper or other widely used media in your community no later than November 14th, letting people know where they can get copies of these documents, how to make comments, when the comments are due, and when you will be having a public meeting to take any comments. This is about the letter. You know, you need a new letter every year. We have a list in here of who you go to get it. Haven't seen a state turn anybody down yet getting their letter. This is one of those things you just got to punch on the checklist, make sure you get it done. So those are the threshold criteria. I think we've got some emailed questions, and so we'll go through these, and also if anybody's got a question just on the threshold stuff or anything else that we've covered so far, then we'll do it now.
The leader has unmuted your line.
We answered the question about community notification being required for what types of grants? Only cleanup. If you have a tribal authority who's part of a coalition but not the lead coalition member, does that authority need a letter? I'm going to say yes, especially since the tribe would go to itself probably to get the letter. So I'm not sure it's a real problem to begin with.
Well, wouldn't they need to say we agree to become a part of this coalition?
Yes.
Is that what they're asking?
So you're going to need a letter that says the tribe's is willing to be part of the coalition, and that the tribal authority, the tribal governing council, approves of the submission of the application.
There's one other question about the cost match. The question is there a look back on the 20% cost match as long as the match is spent on eligible activities? And with that, what I would say is, in your budget, you should include under each of the tasks approximately how you're going to meet that match. So it has to be, the match has to be for eligible activities. So what you would do is include a separate line for your cost match, and you can include the approximate amount in each of those tasks so that it's clear, and your project, you should be clear that those are, your cost match is being spent on eligible activities, and you do need to track that and include your expenditures in your quarterly report.
But that look back question, I think, was asking, can you count cost share for things that have already occurred that are eligible?
Oh.
And the answer to that would be no. If that to be an eligible cost, it has to be an eligible activity within the eligible contemporaneous period, which would mean once the grant is awarded or a pre-award approval has been given.
I think we've got one more. Question about a phase one, September 29th, they took ownership April 2010. Well, if they, I think they're,
I don't think you can fix it after the fact.
Right. Well, if that's within 6 months, they're fine. If it's not, there's, you can't fix it now. What you can do is give us a call. We'll see if there's a way to decide that there was some ongoing monitoring of the property so that any changes in the RECs that were in the phase one would have been notified. There's any expenditure of money at this point to update the phase one is not going to help anything, so don't do that, but do give us a call.
And there's one more question I see here. Is the 20% contribution a part of the $200,000K, or does it boost the total to 240? I believe this is for a cleanup grant. And the answer is it boosts it to 240. The 20% cost share for the RLF and the cleanup grants is a 20% of the grant award given, which in our maximums that we list, the 200,000 and 1 million, are what we give in a grant, not the total budget. So a $200,000 cleanup grant request would include a budget of 240,000, and the 40,000 would be the match portion for eligible activities, as would a $1 million RLF proposal for funding would have a budget of $1.2 million of eligible costs, but the other 200 or 20% would be in a cost share.
Okay, I think we're going to open it up to anybody on the phone that has questions up to this point. So press #6 to unmute to answer or ask a question.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds like no questions. So we're going to continue on with slide 54.
This is Carrie. I'll be going on from here. Under the ranking criteria, again, your proposal is split up into two parts, threshold, which is the pass or fail. You're either in or out to compete at the national level based on the answers you provide at the threshold criteria. The ranking criteria are the creative writing on which you are graded and scored against other people in your same category. For all of you who are in Region 5 on this call, your ranking criteria will be could be sent anywhere in the country to be ranked, so you're competing equally with other areas of the country. There are four ranking criteria: the community need, which is the makeup of your community, the project description is what you plan to do, community engagement partnership, which is how you have engaged your community and how you will continue to keep them involved. And then the fourth are the quantitative and qualitative benefits of the plan you have proposed. As far as the ranking criteria, be very careful of the point totals and make sure you answer all the questions. There is usually an A, B, and a C on the questions, and if you skip one part, you get 0 points on that. Even if you've applied in past years, I always suggest that people go through line by line of the new proposal guidelines under the ranking criteria, because sometimes we switch things around, and it would be a shame to lose points in an area just for lack of an answer. And also because of our page limit issues this year, how we're very specific on the page limits for the ranking criteria, the limit is 15 pages. Please be aware of that as you're composing your answers. On slide 55, what I just stated was that under each question and ranking criteria, we do have subcategories, and a general statement to answer one big question is going to be much more difficult to award points to than answering each subpart individually. The total points for assessment grants are 200, and cleanup and RLF is 100. That doesn't mean anything for you except that there are so many assessment grants that are for which people apply, and last year in our region there was a 90% failure rate, meaning we only awarded 1 in 10 assessment grants, and it was really hard to delineate when we got down to 100 points on a 94 from a 93. So we have it up to 200 points now to really try and flesh out the differences between proposals. The next slide is 56, and this, if you went through the proposal guidelines yourself and tried to add them all up, don't bother. We've done it for you. This is a new breakdown of the points, so you can get an idea when you're trying to look at the 15 pages you have to answer the ranking criteria. This is a nice way to double-check and make sure that you've filled in enough information according to how we are weighting that. Oh, on slide 57, under community need, which is the first section, we have two parts, and I've seen a lot of people answer it in one, and these are two distinct questions, health and welfare and the environment, meaning how are the brownfields in your community affecting the specific neighborhoods and health of your specific community. The second part are the economics, and I highly suggest that you do keep these two portions separate instead of doing a general summary, and that also you take advantage of tables to present demographic data because it can sometimes get lost in narrative. It's not required, but it is helpful. And also under community needs, some of the changes are that additional things we're asking for, providing information on cumulative environmental impacts. This is on page 58, and how they've contributed to a proportionate impact on your community. The second thing is an opportunity to describe how some major things like the whole auto sector shakeup and plant closures and other things have caused unique economic distress in your community. On slide 59, this is an important section because it's often looked over in the ranking criteria, the health, welfare, and environment. This is a unique opportunity to provide interesting things about your demographics and how they are affecting your community and the sensitive populations in your community. This is a chance when you think of reviewers reading 50 different proposals or 20 or whatever it is, this is a unique chance to describe who you really are and who the people in your community are. On slide 60, under community need, it's exactly what I said. Having the statistics from your health department, having up-to-date statistics, discussing not just health but welfare and the environment, these are important to give us a visual clue about your community since we do not allow photos or maps. This is a nice way of being able to describe what's going on. Under slide 61, we ask that you provide information on sensitive populations, and we've given a list here because oftentimes folks may limit this in their heads as they're writing these as only one sensitive population is children, but there are many different sensitive populations, and there is a lot of information from your local or state health departments and online and that you can find in talking to different community groups as part of your outreach to see what are the important issues with those folks and provide the statistics here. On slide 62, this is a really nice way to provide, again, as I said before, a table of information. If you know most of your sites are chlorinated solvents and then you discuss the health effects, you're making a nice tie-in to what your needs are and what these grant funds will do to help alleviate those. On slide 63, the same as the health data and the community need data, the financial need, poverty rates, income rates, unemployment rates, using this table format, getting the most up-to-date information, having census data from 2000 when most of the 2010 census data is, at least in general, available or something more recent would really be helpful. And don't forget to give a source for your data that you're providing in your tables and also to compare it to state and national. And by that, I remind you that your proposals might end up in Texas or Alaska or other states, so it's important to give to use that table on page 20 of the proposal guidelines, which shows you how to format that demographic information.
Right. The tables we have here are examples that we've pulled from previous years. In this year's guidelines, there is a table to use. Use that one. Don't invent your own table format. Don't use this specific example that we've put here because that's what's going to get you in trouble. Use the one in the guidelines.
And with that, we'll skip to slide 66. And before I talk about the project description, I remind you that you do get a two-page cover letter to attach to your proposal. I suggest you use it to tell a story about your community or whoever your signing official is writing the cover letter, because it's your first opportunity to describe what your community is, why you're applying for these funds, and what you intend to do with them. Because if you jump right into the threshold eligibility things without that cover letter telling a story about your community, you miss an opportunity to distinguish yourselves from all the other applications that we'll be reading. This is the second opportunity to do that on slide 66 with the project description. Even though many of these proposals in the RLF and a community-wide assessment category are general ones, they're not site-specific, this is still an opportunity to talk about the corridor, the neighborhood, the census tract, the area that or areas that you're focusing on. And new to this area, new to this category under ranking criteria is that communities with existing community plans, master plans, sustainability plans will receive increased points for having already looked at that planning. And for coalitions, that you must assess a minimum of 5 sites under the grant. And then you can read what's listed. Refer to Section 6E, Brownfield's programmatic requirements for the types of expectations for the projects funded with these grants. On slide 67, obviously you have to, this is part of the requirement that you describe the project to be funded, but for the cleanup proposals, you also need to describe, as we stated earlier with the APCA requirement, what the proposed cleanup plan is and any site reuse plans and or institutional or engineering controls. And we've given you a breakdown again of the different point criteria under that project description. Project description on page 68 for RLF. You need to describe your Brownfields redevelopment program, and we emphasize your because these are grants for you to capitalize your own program. And in the past, we've asked you to tell us how you would market your plan. Now we're requiring you to show that you have a market for your loans and or subgrants. And that doesn't mean you have the exact sites that you plan to do loans or cleanup on, but examples of the sites that could be cleaned up and the people who would be willing to take the loan or subgrant, whether it's another political subdivision of the state, a nonprofit, or a private developer who's interested in these sites and interested in this type of debt financing, or if it's eligible for a subgrant. I can't stress enough how important it is to really have an idea of how you're going to use these funds and who would need them in this area of the project description.
The next thing you're going to be scored on is providing a budget for your project. Again, in this case, use the table that we provide. Don't try to invent your own. Pretty clear, I think, how we'd like you to structure that, how to break out your costs. Some general hints are when you're doing your cost estimates, explain the basis for those. So when you're talking about your cost estimate for doing phase twos, give us an estimate of how many you think you might do and how much they might cost. Phase ones, that estimate should be much clearer. If you're going to count personnel costs like salaries and benefits, give us, again, rates and units. Tell us what the hourly rate or the fringe benefit percentage is for the person working on grant-related activities and how much time they're going to spend on it. People routinely get themselves into trouble by throwing a number, an unsupported number, in the personnel items, which ends up making it look like the part of the grant is just to pay someone's salary, with really no direct connection to working on the project that the grant's supporting. You know, make sure that the costs that you're claiming are eligible. We have long descriptions in the appendices of what are not eligible costs. And again, you know, use the budget tables. There's a couple, the next few pages, the next few slides are show the format there. Slide 74, up to 74, which is leveraging, or your description of how you're going to bring resources other than those that the grant are providing into this project. This has always been a ranking criteria, but this year it's getting a lot more attention. We've tried in the past to use this to figure out, you know, who our best partners in these would be, who can, you know, bring resources that we don't provide to bear on their project. And we found that the way the guidelines had been structured previously did not do a great job of helping us sort that out. So starting this year...
Odor list? Okay, please press star 6. There are people talking. Thank you.
So starting this year, we're going to ask for much more documentation of your plans to leverage your project and leverage the federal funds that we're providing. You know, the slide here gives you some examples of what those leveraging items are. We're going to be asking this year to see letters from that you know, provide some documentation of the leveraging claims that you're making. We're not, you know, in the past people have often provided just a big long list of any place they might go to find funds to help with their project. This year that's not going to be all that helpful. You know, if you can demonstrate a firm commitment, and that, you know, might be through a letter provided by whomever is going to provide you with some additional support, you know, your application is going to be viewed more favorably and scored better. Programmatic capability, we're on slide 75 now. This is where you will be asked several questions that will, you know, give us, we hope, an idea of how well you will manage your project. It covers a few things. They're different, I think, depending on whether you've had a grant before or not. A couple things. Make sure that you address the question about adverse audit findings. Even if you've never had any adverse audit findings, you know, make sure you explicitly say that. If you have had audit problems, tell us how you're, what you're doing now to fix those. You know, again, 76, this is just some more of the information that we're asking for in this project description part.
So we're on slide 77. Community engagement and partnerships, this is not only what you've already done, but how you'll continue to and plan to engage your target community. And when we say target community, we don't just mean what you're going to public notice in the local paper when you are going to start cleaning something up or do an assessment. This means engagement, which is the extent to which you will engage, the extent to which you will respond and query your community about their interest and ideas for a project, not just inform them. And also, it is the support letters which are required and provided to you by the community-based organizations that are involved. And oftentimes, I know we have a definition in the proposal guidelines about what are community-based organizations, but this could be the local school. It could be faith-based organizations, specific chapters of the Sierra Club, Friends of the Namur River. It can be all sorts of folks that are involved or should be involved in your project. Slide 78 is more specific about how you're going to select sites, and again, the involvement of the community in that site selection or having a specific criteria. In the cleanup planning or the redevelopment and reuse plans for a site, we ask that you report on how you've done it in the past and how you intend to continue reporting and engaging upon your engaging with your community. Slide 79 describes your partnerships, and sometimes, especially in the public sector, political subdivisions of the state or cities work so often hand in hand with their health department or their state that they just they have a hard time describing their relationship because it's so interwoven. And I would say to everyone in this category to take a step back and remember that someone in Alaska or Texas or Maine may be reviewing this proposal and that you need to describe how what your state program is, for example, how you're going to work with your state program. Most people don't know that a VIC, or if you're in Minnesota, is the voluntary cleanup program. The nomenclature, how people describe things on how they interact with their health agency and their state departments is going to be different state by state. So be very clear on what role each partner plays because it can be oftentimes confusing for the reviewers in this section. And slide 80 under CBOs, the community-based organization, again, this is a very prescriptive list. They can provide more detail in their letters of support, but we require that you provide a description of the role and of each community-based organization. And again, this does not mean that you're getting letters from your senators or representatives. They just to tack on more letters onto your proposal. These are ones that will be and will be continue to be involved in your project, and these are required, and so is this list. And trust me, people go through the list in the ranking criteria and then go to the attachments to make sure that each organization you've listed also has an attached support letter.
Yeah, this is a high-value item, and it's really a sort of a three-step process here. You want to identify who your community-based organizations are. You want to get their agreement to provide you help with the project and describe that in the application part. And then you want them to provide you individualized, non-form letters that reiterate their participation and what specifically their role will be in the project. You do those three things, and your application will find success in this part of the proposal.
And that said, on page 81, we describe, we understand that there are unique situations. If you are a small tribe or a small community, there may be no formal organizations because everyone knows each other anyway, or they haven't felt the need to organize outside of existing municipal or tribal structures. And we do give those communities an opportunity to not remember to not skip the this question or not answer it, but you should describe why there aren't any, if there are none, and give a background describing why and how. What is the substitute for that engagement if it's not through a formal community-based organization? On slide 82, we have the big changes in this section for 2012 funding, and that is in addition to requiring a description of the key roles of all these different partners you work with, you're also required to identify how they would facilitate hiring from local job training programs as part of their assessment, cleanup, and redevelopment. And this is one of the things, since we also provide, you know, our grants assessment, RLF, and cleanup grants, we also have a job training grant. And because these are not just assessing a bunch of sites, but they're meant to be redevelopment driven, we really want to make the tie-in to our job training program and hiring locally. There's also in this section added language that EPA may conduct reference checks with the partner organizations identified to confirm. So if you have a CBO listed and a letter attached, don't be surprised if someone from EPA or a contractor calls to confirm their involvement. The last change in this section is on page 83 for 2012. This is asking for examples of how the applicant can satisfy the ongoing engagement requirements, meaning not just we're going to notify, as I said before, a cleanup's going to happen or assessment's going to happen, but the continuing engagement of the community surrounding the project. Slide 84, our project benefits. This is the fourth section in the ranking criteria. And again, this is a, you know, different point values depending on the type of proposal you're submitting. But right here we want to talk about the sometimes the non, some quantitative and some qualitative benefits of this cleanup assessment or reuse. This is another opportunity to distinguish yourself from other applications because you can describe your unique plans and visions for your community. On page or slide 85, again, we want to circle back to your initial part of the ranking criteria was to list the effects on the welfare and health of your community, and now at the end, we tie back to that, and you really should ensure that when you're reading through your proposal that that beginning section that discusses all your needs ties to what you hope the benefits are and that they are connected because we do check for that. And these are the direct and indirect benefits to health and welfare for the public and the surrounding community. A change for 2012 in this section is that applicants must describe how the proposed project will impact or address equitable development issues such as affordable housing, public transit, or urban greening. So we're being much more specific than we have in years past on what types of things we'd like you to address. Slide 87 is an example table that we've pulled from another application to show you how someone else who's been a successful applicant has showed some examples of sites they want to look at and what they believe the benefit will be, and it's tied directly back to some of the needs in their community. It doesn't mean you have to format it this way, but this is one way of doing it. On slide 88, under project benefits, again, this is how we want the numbers here. This is not the qualitative part. This is definitely the quantitative part. Not just it will improve our economy, but how. What are the projections? Give as much numbers and other examples as you can that are directly related to your project area. This is not a section where we want a laundry list of possible benefits, as in it will reduce sprawl. That's not specific enough. Slide 89 under project benefits are the benefits from infrastructure reuse and sustainable reuse. Again, we can't say enough times on how to be specific. this is not just saying I'm going to do all LEED certified buildings. There's a whole lot of things that can be demonstrated in this section for how you're reusing existing sidewalks, streets, electricity, roads, that this is not a new development in the middle of a cornfield, that this is reusing all the funds and resources that have been put into your existing grid. And we've listed some examples of things you could cite if they apply to your project. Now on slide 90, other factors. Do you want to talk about this one more? Oh, I can do this one. On the other factors, we're being very specific again this year on once we come up with the ranking criteria for we rank the proposals based on their scores, there is a final brush of which proposals get funded and which don't that is made by our selection official, and that's to provide some equity around the country. So based on some of these factors, they may balance out if there's a tie between two scores and one is in a region that received no funding and one is in a region that received a lot of funding. There may be some weighting given to the fact that there hasn't been much geographical distribution in the country of these ranking criteria. And we get a lot of questions, and on Tuesday's webinar we got a question, will this not bode well for Region 5 proposals? Are we going to start losing funding to a smaller region? And Matt answered that well in stating that any of these selection, any of these other factors for the selecting official could flip things in either direction. It could either help us or hurt us, and we just won't know until those selections are made. And this is the first year that we've, besides with the petroleum, that we're being explicit about these different factors.
You'll be asked, as part of the application, you'll ask to self-identify what, if any, of these other factors apply to your community.
Okay. We're going to go to slide 93 at this point and kind of sum this up. We know we've got a bunch of questions that have come in through our web participants. But I guess it's important to read the guidelines carefully. A lot of the questions that have come up relate to the proposal content. If you go to section 4, that's Roman numeral 4C, it describes the proposal content that was mentioned. There's now a 15-page limit for the narrative proposal. There's a 2-page transmittal letter, and the attachments, only the attachments that are listed in section 4C, proposal content, can be included. And those include, the attachments include all of the threshold documentation, so that is not included as part of your 15 pages. And the threshold documentation sections are 2B and 3B, section Roman numeral 3B and C, and those are the entity eligibility and property eligibility for the site-specific proposals, your letter for your state from your state or tribal authority, letters of support from your CBOs, letters from your leverage funders, justification for your waiver of the $200,000 limit, letters of commitment from your proposal or your coalition members. So if you're part of an assessment or RLF coalition, petroleum determination letters from your state if you're applying for petroleum site-specific funds, cleanup, I guess, primarily, and then that special consideration checklist that Carrie and Matt just went through. So I would definitely focus, you have to read the guidelines carefully, but definitely look at section Roman numeral 4C. I think you'll find a lot of your answers there. As Matt had mentioned, or Carrie, if a criteria doesn't apply, state why it doesn't apply. What will happen is, if you don't answer a question, the reviewer will look around through the proposal and, you know, kind of do this hunt and seek and try to find, did you answer it somewhere else? And that can be very distracting for a reviewer. So it's very important that in the section where a particular criteria asks for information, if it doesn't apply, state it there. Use the checklist to help you get your proposal together. I think as Carrie mentioned, you may be having people from other regions. You will be having people from other regions reading your proposals. and they may not know what the VIC means or, and what it stands for. So don't use acronyms or technical jargon that someone might not recognize. If you're going to use it, spell it out at first, and then you could probably use the acronym like you would ordinarily in letters. Slide 94, again, contact your state or tribe early. As far as your support letters, if you have questions on eligibility, you can contact any of us or your state or the tribe. Threshold criteria can be discussed, but as I think Matt might have mentioned on our previous discussion, that we cannot go over the ranking criteria with you after this call. Is that correct, Matt?
Yes.
Okay, but threshold questions are always things that we can talk with you with about before you submit your proposal. Again, if you're applying for a petroleum grant, make sure you contact your state to get that low-risk letter. Make sure you set up your public meeting for your cleanup grant and get input and include the required information for the cleanup grants. There are frequently asked questions, one of which has the directions for preparing the ABCA that you will put out with your community notification, and those frequently asked questions are on the internet, and we have a link to that. Slide 95 is, again, just more summary information about the format, and again, there's no limit, page limit for the attachments, but you can only include the required attachments. So that's a new thing, so make sure you follow that again.
And the reason we put that in there is we still continue to get proposals that where a community has attached their entire comprehensive plan or other things to demonstrate that they have one, and we don't need that much detail.
Okay. Slide 96 kind of goes through what I described, and again, this proposal content is right in the proposal guidelines. It's pretty early on. It's section Roman numeral 4C. So this just reiterates mostly what I just went through. The last few slides, 97 is a picture of one of our successful projects, and Mike Gifford is in there if you look, if you know Mike. 98 is other brownfield programs and assistance that are out there. We have area-wide planning projects. It's a pilot program, and I think some of you may have been aware of that from last year, and it's going to continue again, I think, this next year. Job training grants, as Carrie mentioned, are things that you can look at in your community. If there have been job training grants, part of the job training is to enable workers to and train them to do environmental work. So if you're going to tap into, I think this is one of the questions that someone submitted, if you're going to tap into that program to get some of their graduates, that's definitely something that will be in your favor. Targeted brownfield assessments, we'll go briefly mention that again on slide 99. These are just additional resources if you need an assessment done on a property between now and when these grants are announced and awarded. You can go through the TBA links that are included. The regional folks here we have regional contracts, and there's a national contract. Our states also have, as I mentioned earlier, 104 or 128A grants that they can use to provide assistance to do TBAs. Slide 100 is our contact information. Slide 101 are your state contacts for your state support letters. Also for your petroleum low-risk letters, the only state that has a different contact for the petroleum is Ohio. They have a hazardous substance contact and a petroleum contact. Slide 102, again, more resources. One thing I'll mention is the Tab Easy at the very bottom of slide 102. Tab Easy is a tool that can be used to prepare proposals, and this software has been updated to mesh with our current guidelines, and there will be, if you look on CLUIN, there will be two sessions of this offered, I think, at the end of October. Actually, I think next week So check the CLUIN website if you want to learn how to use this service, because it can be helpful. Okay, one other thing that I want to just have Matt talk about briefly that you talked about in the last session was how to have your targeted community and your benefits and all of that flow through the proposal so that your outcomes and your outputs and your benefits are reflective of that community and the needs that are identified by that community.
Okay. I think, you know, Carrie hit on that a bit, but you want to, this whole, throughout your scoring, the ranking part, you want to try to use the mosaic that is the way our grant guidelines are set up to show us some kind of picture of what you're going to be doing. So we ask you to describe your target community. And in doing that, you know, I think you really want to provide us with as specific a description of where you're going to be conducting work as you can. And that description is going to, the scale of that is probably going to depend on what size your community is. So if you're in a smaller community like the, you know, little town that I live in outside Chicago, your target community might be your entire municipality, because you might be able to deal with brownfields throughout the entire community. If you're a big city like Chicago, Detroit, or Cleveland, there's no way that you're going to be dealing with brownfields throughout the entire community. There's just not enough money there. So, you know, tell us where you're going to be spending this money and what those conditions are, what the brownfield problems are there, what the health problems are there, what the financial needs are there. And then track not only your needs to that specific description of your target area, but also the benefits that you're expecting. So if you've told us that you have high rates of unemployment in this area, tell us how your benefits are going to create jobs. If you have, you know, poor housing stock, tell us how your job's going to improve the housing stock. Last year was what I described as like the cure obesity year, which was I got to the project benefit, and last thing would be they'd say, and we're going to end up with more open space so people can exercise and reduce rates of obesity. And it would be like the first time these people had written anything about that in their entire application. It's like, you know,
it's
like, where did this come from, and why should I even believe that this is part of your plan, because it's, you know, one sentence here that you've tossed in that looks like a throwaway at the end of the application. So make, you know, tell us what your target is, what their problems are, and what are the outcomes that are going to address those problems when you're done with your project.
So like if open space is limited in the community and that's identified up front, then the end result might be to create more open space.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you want me to start with the questions we've gotten?
Yeah.
Read them aloud. So far, folks have typed some questions in, and we're going to do our best to address those now, and then we can open it up. The next question we had was, I'll read it aloud. With regard to equipment costs not being eligible, what about costs such as drilling during a phase two assessment? Is that eligible?
You know, when you're budgeting these things, all costs related to services that you contract for go in the contractual line item. So when you're, you know, estimating your phase two costs, you don't break out the cost of the contractor's equipment and the cost of the contractor's personnel. It all goes in the contractual line item. Equipment costs are eligible. It's just that given our definition of equipment, you're never going to buy anything that we count as equipment.
By the same token, obviously personnel will need to be operating drill rigs. And that is not a cost that goes under personnel in our budget format. Personnel, the budget is written to the entity that is applying for the fund. So if it's, the city of Springfield, it's Springfield's personnel cost. Any personnel cost for operating equipment would be under contractual. The next question is under budget, and there are two questions that relate to, do we need separate lines for hazardous and petroleum, or do you prefer that they be broken out in the budget table or separate budget tables? And the answer is separate budget tables for hazardous and petroleum.
Well,
it's always Yeah, better to look at, easier to look at.
The guidelines let you do it either way. I think what you're hearing is people have a preference that it makes it easier to look at, but the guidelines let you do either.
They let you do either, but if you're successful, we'll make you break it apart anyway later, so you might save yourself some time and do separate tables now, because if you are awarded a grant, we do require them separately. I have a question of TIF is usually based on the amount of eligible activities approved for the TIF. How should we estimate the amount of the TIF?
And our question would be, I don't know, how should you estimate the amount of the TIF? we don't know.
That would be your local rules, and I assume there's a maximum capture rate for the TIF, and then depending on the area that you're looking at that's in the TIF, you could estimate from there which percentage of your max it could be. Next question was, do planned infrastructure or capital improvements in traditional commercial or industrial areas count as leveraging? And I would say yes, if they're supporting the business you are, if you can tie it to the redevelopment plans. And, for example, a new bike trail or, updated water infrastructure will help a new redevelopment you're planning, then yes. But
yeah,
you do need to tie it together, not as a general.
And I would say this year, it's less important how many types of leveraging you can throw in your application and how you can document the chances that the sources of leveraging that you do list will come to reality, come to fruition. So, this is a scoring criteria. You can probably put in whatever you want to put in there. It's a question of how well you document it, and so that the reader, the person scoring it, has reason to credit your application for that.
Okay. So a laundry list of available grants will be weighed much less than one or two specific things that are committed funds. The next question, would the letters documenting leveraging be part of the 15-page total application or be in addition to it? No, they are required attachments, and they are not subject to the 15-page ranking criteria limit. We just got another question. Is the threshold part of the 15-page limit? And no, since the threshold criteria are questions that are, depending if it's site-specific or not, may need more length, that those are also not subject to that 15 point. The 15-page limit is just for the ranking criteria. Next question, can you provide some examples of how a community would facilitate hiring from local job training programs? Do you mean encouraging the contractor to hire locally? And the answer is yes. I'll give you an example in Minnesota where a revolving loan fund existing cooperative agreement holder actually has is providing land and cleanup activities at a site. The redeveloper in their agreement commits to hiring a certain percentage locally. The next question is, does page slide 82?
Oh, and slide 82 does not apply just to assessment. It applies to all of them. This is the description of the key roles and conducting reference checks. That applies to all grants.
Okay. And then was there one more?
Yeah, there's one more. It's a question about the client disposal facility on Lake Erie. I would suggest that you give us a call directly on this one. You can give me a call. This is Matt. I would say that we've had similar questions before about assessment or cleanup for in areas that are not real property, that are, within a waterway or some other natural resource of the state. And those are not eligible. But, the description I've got in the emailed question isn't all that detailed, so give me a call. But, we've had similar questions, and they turn out to be ineligible projects.
Okay. There was one other question about the special considerations checklist.
And are these criteria, are these factors going to be weighted equally?
Don't know.
Okay. Okay. All right, so I think we've gone through all the questions that were submitted via the internet, so we're going to open it up to questions. So, I guess we'll just ask, and if there are too many people, we'll maybe ask for Illinois and then go by state. But press #6 if you want to ask a question.
Okay, we're not hearing any.
I think we have muted, right? Yeah, it's already unmuted. Okay.
I guess
go
we answered everything.
All right.
Again, you have our phone numbers and our contact information there. If you think of a question in the next couple days, regarding the threshold criteria, or just, some general application requirements, give us a call. As we said, we're really not at liberty to advise you on how to, put together your response to the ranking criteria anymore, but if you have a question about whether your project or your site's eligible, please do give us a call. That can save everybody a lot of time later on down the road.
And again, please read the guidelines carefully. It's going to be a very competitive competition, again, because of the reduced funding, if you looked at that. So we'll be rooting for you.
Last call for questions. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.
Thanks, guys. Great job.